Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: rockets strike two military bases hosting U.S. occupation forces in eastern Syria, injuring three American troopers. Tehran says it's reviewing Washington's response to its comments on an EU draft proposal for the revival of the nuclear deal and rejects rumors about the content of the U.S.'s response. Also in our headlines, Taiwan proposes raising its total military spending to $19 billion for next year in a move that could further fuel tensions with China. Hello and welcome everybody. Two military bases hosting U.S. occupation forces in the eastern Syrian province of Deir al-Zour have come under rocket attack. Syria's official Sana News Agency quoted local sources as saying several rockets fell inside the two U.S. military bases located at Al-Omar and Conoco oil fields in the countryside of Deir al-Zour. The sources said the attacks were followed by plumes of smoke rising from the bases. According to a U.S. military statement, three U.S. service members suffered minor injuries. U.S. military aircraft conducted flights over the area of the attacks. The new attacks came after the U.S. military carried out airstrikes on eastern Syria on Tuesday, claiming it hit facilities used by Iran-linked fighters there. Iran has slammed the latest U.S. airstrikes as a breach of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Tehran has also denied U.S. military claims that its targets were Iran-linked groups. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali explains why the U.S. claims that Iran-linked groups target its bases in Syria are false.
This is the second time that the U.S. In 24 hours claims that those groups targeting it are linked to Iran. While we all know that Iran has no troops or forces in Syria, yes, there are some military advisors at the request of the Syrian government, but there are no troops, and the United States never actually gave any proof that those groups, as it claims, are linked to Iran. This is first what happened, and then after that attack, the U.S. Central Command, in a statement, said that it responded back using helicopters to the source of fire, killing two or three individuals that used a car to attack that site over there. Now, what is very important to point out too is that this time there has been there were three U.S. soldiers injured. Now, it could be any popular group in that area, people of that area, that are sending messages to the United States that you are occupying our territories, you are stealing our oil, and you should leave. This is perhaps how analysts see and people see such attacks against the U.S. Forces of occupation in Syria. They want them out because they are stealing their oil, they are dividing the country, they are supporting terrorism and training armed terrorist groups in that area. So this is definitely a direct message for the U.S. to exit and leave Syria.
Iran says it's reviewing the U.S.'s response to its comments on an EU-drafted proposal to salvage the 2015 nuclear deal. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani has confirmed the receiving of Washington's response through the European Union. He says that Tehran is carefully reviewing the response and will convey its final thoughts through the EU coordinator. There are still some gaps between Iran and the U.S. with regards to the revival of the agreement. Several rounds of talks coordinated by the EU have been held between Iran and the other signatories for nearly 16 months. Iran has been demanding sanctions relief, economic guarantees, as well as assurances that the U.S. will not withdraw from the pact again. And the White House is set to have turned down a request from Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid for an emergency call with President Joe Biden, with Israeli media speculating that the rebuff could be linked to the ongoing negotiations over the Iran nuclear deal. Based on reports, Biden's office has said the president cannot talk over the phone because he's currently on vacation. Also, according to Israeli news outlets, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz will not be able to meet with Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin during his visit to Washington on Thursday because he will be out of town. Gantz has said he's visiting the U.S. to convey the Tel Aviv regime's concerns about the Iran deal. The Israeli regime is seemingly ramping up anti-Iran efforts amid fresh hopes for the renewal of the 2015 deal. The agreement was thrown into limbo due to the U.S. withdrawal and the return of sanctions against Iran 4 years ago. When it comes to nuclear weapons, there's no justification in its possession, let alone its use. Yet countries like the U.S. believe they are entitled to have them while dictating others not to have those weapons. Iran, meanwhile, has called for the complete elimination of nuclear weapons, especially in West Asia. The only obstacle in that regard is Israel, which refuses not only to disclose its stockpile, but doesn't move towards its elimination.
Iran has once again raised the alarm bells over Israel's nuclear stockpile, saying the regime must destroy its nuclear weapons. The remarks were made by Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations, Majid Takht-Ravanchi. He also expressed concern over the lack of progress in the implementation of the 1995 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT resolution, and the 2010 Action Plan on the Middle East. NPT is a landmark international treaty whose objective is to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons and weapons technology. In 1995, the NPT Review Conference adopted a resolution on the Middle East calling on states to take practical steps to make progress in the establishment of region free of weapons of mass destruction.
The countries that have nukes are not supporting nuclear disarmament. They aren't supporting the new treaty, which has been signed by many, many other countries in the United Nations, forbidding anyone to have nuclear weapons. So I don't know what the answer is, except that I think Iran is on the right side of history in this particular context.
Takht-Ravanchi also slammed double standards adopted by the United States with regards to Israel, saying the regime in Tel Aviv must join the NPT, quote, without precondition and further delay, and place all of its nuclear activities under the comprehensive International Atomic Energy Agency safeguards. Iran says the move is essential in realizing the goal of universal adherence to the treaty in the Middle East and establishment of a nuclear weapon free zone in the Middle East.
But Israel is very aggressive. The people there are very deluded. They think that somehow they can acquire control over much larger areas of the Middle East than they already have, instead of understanding that they're losing control of the area they have right now. And the United States uses Israel as sort of a base, an aircraft carrier bordering on the rest of the Middle East.
Well, given the fact that Israel is not a member of the NPT and does not allow any UN inspections of its nuclear facilities, it risks security issues such as contamination. For example, Israel's nuclear facilities poses a danger to the Palestinian territories and their environment. It's been cited that Israel buries its nuclear waste and hazardous material in the occupied West Bank.
Israel has pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity with regards to its nuclear policy. But it's an open secret that the regime is the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in this region. Based on estimations, the regime is believed to possess 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal. Israel has, however, refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the NPT. But the regime has been emboldened by the support from the United States and European states. Washington and its allies have refused to press Israel to open up its nuclear arsenal to international inspections. Israel is the world's eighth largest nuclear power and initiated its nuclear program in 1952 with technological support from France and the US, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful nuclear program. The regime's secret nuclear program was made known thanks to technician Mordechai Vanunu, who blew the lid off Pandora's box back in 1986.
As far as Israel goes, I think they're going to, they're losing support of the global community rapidly through their behavior these days, because they've just gone so far outside of reality. Again, their behavior is so unacceptable, and their claims are so surreal that no one can buy them. And even here in the U.S., they're losing support because the people themselves are going, what can you say about, a country that acts like this? There's no excuses left.
The regime's refusal to join international inspections and eliminate its nuclear stockpile comes amid its vehement opposition to Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. Tehran's nuclear activities have been under the full international inspections. Over the years, the regime has assassinated at least 7 Iranian nuclear scientists and conducted a series of sabotage operations against the Islamic Republic's nuclear facilities. The regime has also threatened to launch attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities.
Iran's large-scale nationwide drone drills continue for a second day. Precision strike drones have successfully destroyed mock enemy targets. A spokesman for the drill says different types of drones have been flown on missions covering vast areas from the Persian Gulf in the south all the way to the country's east, west, north, and center. According to Admiral Mahmoud Mousavi, the drills represent the capabilities of a range of domestically manufactured drones in offensive and defensive scenarios. The Army's ground, naval, air force, and air defense forces are taking part in the first ever combined drills. More than 150 surveillance and combat drones are being put to the test for their control systems and combat capabilities. On the first day, the UAVs carried out intelligence gathering and patrol missions. Well, Taiwan is planning to increase its military budget for 2023 amid rising tensions with China. Taipei has proposed $19 billion in defense spending, which must be approved by the parliament. That's nearly 14% higher compared to last year's budget. The new funds will be spent on purchasing new fighter jets. For 6 years in a row, Taipei has raised its military funding. The situation remains volatile around the Taiwan Strait, with both China and Taiwan conducting drills in recent weeks. Beijing views the island as its sovereign territory. A visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan earlier this month infuriated China. Beijing views Washington's diplomatic exchanges with and arms sales to Taipei as attempts to boost separatist forces in Taiwan. Moving on to the U.S. city of Uvalde, where the school district's police chief is now out of his job over his poor handling of a tragic shooting.
Mr. Board President, I move that good cause exists to terminate the non-certified contract of Pete Arredondo effective immediately. I further move that good cause exists to ratify the unpaid leave status of Mr. Arredondo starting July 19, 2022. Finally, I move to authorize the superintendent to issue written notice to Mr. Arredondo of this board action, including filing any needed reports required by the termination.
The city school board has decided to dismiss Officer Pete Arredondo for failing to act in time to protect the victims of the massacre at the Texas Elementary School about 3 months ago. As many as 19 children and 2 teachers were killed in that rampage. The victims' parents had been demanding the police officer's dismissal. Arredondo, however, denies the charges, saying that he did not hold back his team from responding to the shooter. His attorney is also critical of the school board for making the decision without conducting an investigation to obtain evidence. The economic crisis in the Eurozone may be getting started, with data showing a slowdown of recession-level proportions. For many, the question is not for how many seasons will the bloc be in recession, but for how many years. Irene Mazzotti has more from Paris.
Evidence continues to mount that France and the Eurozone are facing a long period of recession. French economic output just contracted for the first time in 18 months, with Germany's business activity plunging even deeper. The decline in output and demand has almost too many causes to list. At 6 months into the unrest in Ukraine, Europe's energy import costs have now quadrupled. The costly conflict shows no sign of easing as Brussels has abandoned diplomatic efforts with Moscow. The current drought across the continent appears to be the worst in the last 500 years, hurting crop yields, sparking wildfires, and increasing pessimism. That's helped push the euro to its lowest level in 20 years. The euro is now worth less than the United States dollar.
There are obviously many crises which are causing major problems for Europe, and many are linked to what's going on in Ukraine. However, we should not forget the supply chain problems which began with the coronavirus pandemic, nor the European sovereign debt crisis.
Despite the increase in gloom, last month the European Central Bank decided to raise interest rates for the first time in 11 years. That makes borrowing even more costly for businesses and individuals and could spark mass layoffs, bankruptcies, and home foreclosures. The U.S. has hiked interest rates faster than in Europe, while indicating that more rate increases will arrive soon. Since the Great Recession began, Western central banks have aligned their policies, though they do not move in an exact lockstep. The cost of living crisis is expected to significantly worsen this winter. However, many say a negative outlook for the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc is more accurately described in years and not just seasons.
Inflation is something which could penalize the average person for 1, 2, or maybe even 3 years. So we are witnessing how the average French household is getting much, much poorer. Senior citizens are especially being hurt, and this will have major political consequences in France.
Analysts say a possible solution to Europe's energy crisis is to implement the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. However, both Washington and Tel Aviv continue to hinder Europe's ability to protect its own economic interests. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
in the limelight. The former New York mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, has been told that he is the target of the investigation concerning whether Donald Trump and his associates tried to illegally influence the 2020 presidential election results in Georgia. The article you're about to hear has been written by Richard Fawcett, a New York Times correspondent and former Los Angeles Times reporter. The article has been published by the New York Times and is titled, Giuliani Appears Before Atlanta Grand Jury Investigating Trump. Rudolph W. Giuliani, the former lawyer for Donald J. Trump and a target in the criminal investigation into Mr. Trump's efforts to overturn Georgia's results in the 2020 presidential election, spent hours behind closed doors on Wednesday taking questions as part of a special grand jury proceeding. But a lawyer for Mr. Giuliani declined to say whether he answered any of those questions. It is unclear what crimes Mr. Giuliani could be charged with in the sprawling investigation of Mr. Trump and his allies being led by Fannie Willis, the district attorney in Fulton County, Georgia. Rudolph Giuliani, a 78-year-old, made numerous false claims about election fraud after the November 2020 election in Georgia state legislative hearings. He also participated in a scheme to create slates of fake presidential electors in 2020 in numerous states, including in Georgia. That is now the subject of an intensifying investigation by the Justice Department. Legal experts said Mr. Giuliani, who, as a target of the inquiry, could eventually face indictment, might have declined to answer many or most of the questions posed to him on Wednesday, either by invoking attorney-client privilege or his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Mr. Giuliani indicated that he was likely to invoke attorney-client privilege in an interview this week with Newsmax, the far-right news outlet. If Mr. Giuliani left most questions unanswered, his appearance in Atlanta, Georgia, would have echoed Mr. Trump's marathon session at a deposition earlier this month in Manhattan, New York, in which the former president invoked his Fifth Amendment right more than 400 times as part of an investigation into his company's business practices. If those appearances underscore the legal peril the two men may face, other developments in the Georgia case highlight the combustible political atmosphere in which it is being conducted. On Wednesday, 17th of August, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican who resisted Donald Trump's efforts to overturn his Georgia defeat, filed a motion to quash a subpoena to appear before the special grand jury. Among other things, Brian Kemp argued that it was unfair that he might be called to testify in the midst of his heated re-election contest against his Democratic rival, Stacey Abrams. On Tuesday, 16th of August, 11 of the 16 pro-Trump alternate electors from Georgia filed a motion seeking to have Fannie Willis, a Democrat, disqualified from the investigation because she headlined a fundraiser for a Democrat running for lieutenant governor. All 16 of these Republican electors have been identified as targets of the investigation by Fulton County prosecutors. And U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, the South Carolina Republican, said this week that he would appeal a federal judge's order that he appear before the special grand jury, arguing that his required participation amounted to a weaponization of the law. Soon after the 2020 election, Lindsey Graham made a pair of phone calls to Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State, in which Lindsey Graham inquired about ways to help Donald Trump by invalidating certain mail-in votes. Mr. Giuliani appeared chipper on Wednesday as he arrived at the Fulton County Courthouse in downtown Atlanta, Georgia, before 9 a.m. in a black GMC Yukon Denali. He was accompanied by his lawyer, Robert Costello, and Vernon Jones, a Georgia politician who has echoed Donald Trump's false claims that the Georgia election was rigged against him. Asked what he expected to talk about, Rudolph Giuliani told a large crush of reporters outside the courthouse, "They'll ask the questions and we'll see." He did not emerge from the courthouse until after 3 p.m., when he was whisked away by the same black SUV. He did not stop to talk about how it went. "He came and did what he was supposed to do," said William Thomas Jr., another lawyer for Mr. Giuliani. "The grand jury process is secret, and we're going to respect that." It was a markedly different visit than the one Rudolph Giuliani made to Atlanta in December of 2020, when he appeared at one of the legislative hearings at the elegant gold-domed Capitol, making fanciful accusations of election fraud. He was greeted at the time in a manner befitting the emissary of the most powerful man on earth, posing for photographs with admirers and sympathetic state politicians. On Wednesday, he found himself in the court complex where Atlantans go to resolve real estate disputes, file for divorce, or be arraigned for armed robberies. Fannie Willis has asked the FBI to provide stepped-up security at the courthouse, after Donald Trump called prosecutors like her vicious, horrible people. Rudolph Giuliani's lawyers fought to keep him from having to travel to Atlanta. Instead, they offered to have him appear via video conference and argued that he was too feeble to travel by air after having a pair of cardiac stents inserted in early July. But Judge Robert McBurney ruled last week that Mr. Giuliani could always travel on a train, on a bus or Uber. This week, lawyers for Mr. Giuliani declined to say how he managed to get to Atlanta, Georgia from New York. In court documents, the Georgia prosecutors described the subject of their investigation as a multi-state coordinated plan by the Trump campaign to influence the results of the November 2020 election in Georgia and elsewhere. Fannie Willis has said that the inquiry could result in a multi-defendant racketeering or conspiracy case. The ambitious scope of the investigation was hinted at on Wednesday in Brian Kemp's motion, which noted that the governor's office had already turned over 117,000 pages of documents. Even if Rudolph Giuliani did not answer many questions on Wednesday, his appearance may have been of some use to prosecutors. Unlike a trial jury, which would be instructed not to make any inferences about a criminal defendant's silence, a grand jury is allowed to draw its own conclusions when witnesses or targets invoke their Fifth Amendment rights. The special grand jury in Georgia cannot indict anyone. Its job is to write a report saying whether the jurors believe crimes occurred. A regular grand jury could then issue indictments based on the special jury's report. Paige Pate, a veteran Georgia trial lawyer, said that even if Rudolph Giuliani declined to answer most questions, some important details could emerge from his appearance. "Why not just grill him and see what happens?" Mr. Pate said. Two other lawyers on the Trump team, Jenna Ellis of Colorado and John Eastman of New Mexico, have also been told to appear before the special grand jury. Jenna Ellis unsuccessfully argued that she should not have to testify in Atlanta during a court hearing on Tuesday in Fort Collins, Colorado. She's expected to come to Georgia on 25th of August. John Eastman is expected to appear at a court hearing in Santa Fe on 26th of August. Brian Kemp, in his motion to quash his subpoena, argues that Fannie Willis's office has no legal right to subpoena the governor at all. It also claims that prosecutors engaged in delay and artificial deadlines in negotiations over Mr. Kemp's appearance, resulting in the possibility that he would be forced to testify in the middle of an election cycle. Two separate subpoenas attached to the motion asked Brian Kemp to give testimony on 10th of August and 18th of August. At worst, Brian Kemp's motion says the timing of the subpoenas could be seen as an attempt to influence the November 2022 midterm elections. It adds, what began as an investigation into election interference has itself devolved into its own mechanism of election interference. A spokesperson for the district attorney's office could not be reached for comment, but in a letter to Brian McAvoy, a lawyer for Brian Kemp, Fannie Willis said that his assertions about a political motivation were offensive and beneath an officer of the court. Fannie Willis added, you are both wrong and confused.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. military has carried out a strike in Syria's Deir al-Zor against what it called infrastructure facilities used by groups affiliated with Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC. Iran's official reaction, it denied having any links to sites targeted by the U.S. in Syria. Why does the U.S., who is occupying Syrian soil, believe that it can target anything inside Syria? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the volatile situation in Syria, in particular northern Syria, created due to the U.S. illegal presence there, and the significance of the timing of U.S. strikes coming at a time when U.S. and Iran are engaged in the JCPOA revival talks. First, let's get an update from our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, who joins us from Damascus. Mohammed, at this point, to give us a recap about these strikes that have occurred, that the U.S. actually executed, it seems like 24 hours ago.
Yes, yesterday the United States carried out a strike on a location in Deir al-Zor province, claiming it was targeting an area where there is a group linked to Iran over there. However, Iran rejected that claim as false, and this is not the first time that the United States carries out such a strike. Yes, that just last year there was a similar one. This U.S. strike comes just recently after one of its bases in Syria, in Al-Tanf area, was hit over there and was subjected to a drone attack. Of course, no one claimed responsibility for that attack at that time. Now, what is interesting is what the statement of the United States said with regards to the goal of this strike. It said that it is aimed at protecting the U.S. forces inside Syria. And here, if you ask analysts, it's interesting to hear such a statement, because what the United States is trying to do is to tell the world, or portray to the world, that it is in a state of self-defense. Well, the reality is the opposite. The United States is not in a state of self-defense. It is attacking the civilians, attacking the Syrian people, striking their homes, looting its resources, the oil, for example, inside Syria, dividing the country by supporting so-called SDFA and giving them hope for a creating some kind of a statelet. So all of the practices of the United States in Syria are illegal. It is occupying the country, and it's targeting any side that actually fights terrorism, while it's claiming that it itself is fighting terrorism, which is opposite to the reality on the ground.
Thank you very much for that, Mohammed Ali, of course, one of them from Damascus. At this point, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Our guest, Sarah Flounder, joins us. She's the co-director of the International Action Center from New York. Also joining us is Ken Stone, Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who joins us from Hamilton, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Sarah Flounders, I'm going to first start with you and ask you a simple question about why we're looking at, or Ken Stone, I guess we're starting with you first. I'm sorry. Ken Stone, looking at the strike that has taken place, it wasn't a simple operation. According to reports, there were 8 U.S. fighter jets, 4 which were composed of 4 F-16 and 4 F-19E. Doesn't sound like a very simple operation there. I believe Sarah Flounders then is with us for this question. And it was reported 9 targets were hit in Syria. Why do you think at this point this has been carried out, Sarah Flounders, by the U.S.?
Well, first of all, it's an absolutely illegal attack and an outrageous attack on Syria's sovereignty. But at this time, what is most threatening to the U.S. government is peace. The very idea that Turkey may be entering into discussions with Syria, that there might be a change among all the forces in the region in their attitude towards Syria, is absolutely threatening to the U.S. And it's also a time when the countries of the world who want to move forward with the JCPOA, that's threatening to the U.S. While officially they claim to be for it, they are not for peace anywhere. They need war, and they will use their vast, air force, their whole armadas, in order to constantly instigate wars.
But the one response here has been, Ken Stone, that this U.S. attack, and I'm quoting Iran, on Syrian infrastructure and people, a violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The sites that were targeted had no links to the Islamic Republic. Do you believe the way that the U.S. is using the association of anything inside Syria with Iran to be, first of all, a valid reason for the U.S. to target what it claims to be Iran-backed groups or anything associated with IRGC at this point?
I do not think it's a valid reason. The government of Iran is an ally of the Syrian government. The Syrian government under President Bashar al-Assad invited the Iranian government to send armed forces to Syria to help protect it against the regime change operation that was launched under the auspices of the U.S. to overthrow the government of Syria and to carve up Syria into various little statelets, the better to gobble them up. This is part and parcel of the U.S. agenda all over the world. The U.S. does not recognize the territorial integrity of other countries or their sovereignty, and routinely, since the Second World War, has been at war with one country or other in the world. And in Syria, they have been trying to overthrow the government since the mid-1970s. The first sanctions, U.S. sanctions against Syria, I think, were 1972. The preparations for the regime change operation, which started under the auspices of the U.S. and its coalition of partners, with a shooting operation, a shooting war in 2011, was actually started. The preparations started in 2005 and 2006. Since the shooting war started, the U.S. has supported armed terrorist groups inside of Syria, including Daesh, which we call ISIS here in North America. And they have supported, they have created a number of illegal military bases, including the bump at Al Tanf base over the border from Jordan. And in eastern Syria, the U.S. Has conducted out-and-out occupation for the past few years, sitting on the oil fields, as Trump said, to take the oil and gas, but also in an alliance with the SDF, a Turkish separatist outfit that's seeking to carve a Kurdish state out of parts of Syria, Iraq, Iran, Turkey. So the U.S. routinely in Syria and around the world has been disrespecting other countries' sovereignty and territorial integrity.
Well, Sarah Flanders, the U.S. has come out and said that these strikes that were exercised 24 hours ago, they were actually necessary because they were meant to protect and defend U.S. personnel. Now, that it's pretty ironic for the U.S. to say that when it's on Syrian soil without the invitation of Bashar al-Assad and is there violating, as our guest there said, Syria's sovereignty, and yet it claims that it's to protect American personnel. How is that possible for the U.S. To say that? And then who's the buyer of that stance?
There is no basis for any U.S. forces to be in Syria, be bombing Syria, to be running camps of terrorists in Syria, and they run, at this point, still 19 camps, to be stealing Syrian oil, which they are doing in thousands of container trucks that move across Syria. None of this has any basis in legality. It's absolute piracy. It's an effort to dismember Syria. It's an effort to actually break up the whole region. It is also aimed at Iran, who is there, as Ken very accurately said, at the invitation of the Syrian government and has given real solidarity and assistance. Now, the U.S. has a regime change plan for Iran, too, and they want to inflame all the relations in the region and are threatened by any effort of the countries of the region to come to an agreement, even to come to a ceasefire. They're threatened by that, and they will use their war instruments, and in this case, you know, F-16s, F-15Es, those aren't small. That's not a drone attack. This is really U.S. fighter jets bombing Syria, and they have done that since 2015, and they have imposed sanctions in an effort to destabilize Syria for decades. So every step of this is completely illegal, an attack on the sovereignty of Syria and an effort to destabilize the entire region. There's no legal basis for it whatsoever, and yet they will always assert this is part of some rules-based order. What that rule is simply the U.S. is supposed to rule, and that is being challenged. That certainly is being challenged.
Well, the mere presence of the U.S. on Syrian soil, on the one hand, and for it to have a military base in Al Tanf is what the U.S. has cited to be the reason when it was attacked by a drone, I guess, for what happened 24 hours ago, Kent Stone. You talked about how this Al Tanf has been reported to train terrorists and for it to have U.S. either direct or indirect cooperation with these terrorists or terrorist groups that operate in and out of this camp. Tell us more about that, because that is something that both Iran and Russia have accused the U.S. when it comes to this particular Al Tanf garrison, which is used by the U.S. forces.
Well, Al Tanf is on the Jordanian border, but there's a bump now since 2011 onto the Syrian side. And on the Syrian side, the camp, the enlargement of the camp, which is totally illegal and a violation of the sovereignty of the Syrian people, is being used to train Daesh terrorists for renewed attacks on Syria. As you know, the Syrian government, with the help of Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Russian government, managed to defeat about 90% of Syria. The U.S. has started to use the Al-Tanf base to reorganize the disparate groups of terrorists, Islamic terrorists that it has supported, and it's using that base to try and encourage further incursions and destabilization in the western part of western and southern parts of Syria. The Russians have said that as well, and the Russians have attacked that base twice with planes in the last month, and they have even notified the U.S. in advance of these attacks and told them where they were coming and why they were attacking the base. And I believe that the Russians were delivering a message to the Americans saying, we are not going to tolerate much longer your training of terrorists inside of Syria to destabilize our Syrian ally.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a great point that you make there about the Russian involvement. And Sarah Flounders, I'd like to find out what is going on there when it comes to Russia. Russia has said, it's being, as our guest there explained fully, about Al-Tanf, how U.S. uses the training of Daesh terrorists there. But it seems like Russia has stepped up its not only actions about targeting those terrorists there, but also being very vocal about the fact that, you know, the U.S. should discontinue doing what it's doing. Do you think that Russia is now in this mode where it will continue on this path, targeting areas around Al-Tanf, some deducting that that perhaps is a message also to U.S. when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, certainly it is linked, because the hope that some accommodation with U.S. could be reached no longer exists in Russia today. And so in the past, there was an effort to do two things and use diplomacy and so on very often. But now it's clear that the effort is to dismember Russia and to use NATO and to hammer away in totally destructive ways. That's one step. It's a lot to do also with sabotaging the JCPOA, the very idea that the U.S. would, a treaty they signed the Security Council, all the countries of the world supported it, and it was the U.S. who ripped it up. So it means any of the treaties that they wouldn't expand NATO, every agreement, treaty that they have made, they are violating now more aggressively than ever. And because their influence is waning in the region and globally, they are more and more forced to use the only power they have, which is substantial, and that is their military power. Now, Russia today is challenging that and showing, certainly in Ukraine, and also they have the ability to give real assistance to Syria and to the countries of the region. They have military capacity, and that's important to recognize and very helpful for the countries of the region that are trying to survive. So these things are really intensely connected, and there are other countries that are looking at it and stepping back from their alliance, such as Turkey, with NATO, with the U.S., and thinking they should find ways to reach accommodation economically in trade and perhaps also politically. And that would be a real contribution and of assistance to Syria if Turkey's role changed. That's very threatening to the U.S., and they want to do everything they can to break that
and to assert themselves. I don't think it'll be very successful. Mm-hmm. It's one more way in which they're really exposed, and it more shows their weakness and their inability to follow any of the agreements they've made.
Well, at the center of this, if you agree, Ken Stone, is the fact that the U.S. is creating instability due to its illegal presence on the ground there in Syria. I think we agree on that. But there's other factors here involved, such as Turkey's role, where it is after the Kurds, of which the U.S. is backing, of which Turkey is targeting them and says, we want to actually carve out a territory. The simple solution would be for the U.S. to move out of Syria. But it's not doing that. So this instability is actually just continues. And now we see how Turkey is on the offensive again, even though it promised not to go ahead with its, at least weeks ago when it came to Iran and talked with Iran's leader in Russia's presence. How can this be resolved? I mean, the quick solution, as I stated, is for the U.S. to take off from Syria, but we don't see that happening.
I think that Turkey sent some positive signals to Syria and to the world community in the last few weeks by saying that that it was agreeable to President Putin's request to Mr. Erdogan that Mr. Erdogan find a way to work with President Assad to achieve a political settlement and peace in Syria. And Erdogan was very very vocal about it. He said that he liked the idea and that, in fact, his foreign minister, Mr. Çavuşoğlu, had met the foreign minister of Syria, Mr. al-Mahdad, on the sidelines of the non-aligned meeting last October, and that there was already contact between the intelligence services of both countries. Nonetheless, Turkey a week ago, sent planes and attacked Syria, and three Syrian army soldiers were killed, and six more were wounded. And I feel that Turkey, like the UAE and other countries in the region, have made moves to stop the isolation of Syria and to restore diplomatic relations, bring Syria into the Arab League and back into the Arab League and so forth. However, I'm not sure that this kind of rapprochement can take place between Turkey, which after all was one of the biggest players in the invasion and this destabilization of Syria since 2011. I'm not sure there can be a rapprochement as long as the U.S. is sitting on the eastern third of Syria, where it supports the Kurdish separatists who attack Turkey and create a cycle of violence that Turkey, in exchange, attacks Syria. I think, as you pointed out, the overall solution is for the U.S. to get out of Syria now. And I think that I'm hopeful, and okay, other people in the peace movement are hopeful, that once the special military operation in Ukraine is finished, that the Russian government will turn its attention to the Middle East and especially Syria and put the necessary pressure on the U.S. to get out of Syria and stop destabilizing the entire region with its presence there.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Sarah Flounder is co-director of the International Action Center from New York. Ken Stone, thank you so much. Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War from Hamilton, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at supplication number 8 for Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, found in As-Sahif Sajjadiyah. And we're looking at supplication number 8. We got to the part where the Imam alayhi salam, he says, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from ilhahul shahwa, the urgency of passion, the insistence of desire. We were talking about reasons and causes that makes a person move towards his desires and weakens his iman. And he becomes nothing more than an animal. Or Allah says, بَلْ أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا, however, worse off an animal. One of the causes that makes a person move towards his passion and his desires is in fact friends. Friends play a major role in our life. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, in a beautiful hadith, he says, tell me who your friends are, I will tell you who you are. Because sometimes we are a projection of our friends. Whatever they do, we do. Whatever they like, we like. That's why we are friends. Because if we were different, then we wouldn't be together. So the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, he says, Al-mar'u ala dini qarini, aw ala dini khalili. The person is on the same religion of that of his friend, on the outside and in the inside. When I walk with a person who I say is my friend, people, when they see me, they will say, okay, these guys are the same. They are in the same path. They follow the same ideology. When it comes to my evilness, obviously, whatever I indulge in, my friend does as well, or vice versa. So a friend could be a cause. Let us take a break and then we'll come back right after.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.